provide estimates of the degrees to which modern humans have retained Neanderthal DNA. The research suggests that even people of African descent have Neanderthal heritage, something that was previously in doubt. Research published this past week in Cell has identified significant traces of Neanderthal ancestry in African populations. The new paper, co-authored by geneticist Joshua Kay from Princeton University, claims that African individuals have a stronger Neanderthal ancestry signal than previously thought. The findings complicate our understanding of the human origins and migration patterns that contributed to the makeup of our species. Quote, so far, estimates of Neanderthal ancestry in European and Asians have used the assumption that Africans carry no Neanderthal ancestry, although we know that that was not strictly true. Sivan Pabo, a geneticist at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, told reporters. We knew there was some in Africans, the result of a supposed migration event that happened a long time ago, said Pabo, who wasn't involved with the new research. The new paper affirms these assumptions, suggesting interbreeding events that date back as far as 100,000 to 200,000 years ago. Investigations into the Neanderthal genome, which was sequenced in 2010, have suggested that anatomically modern humans of Eurasian descent have retained about 2% Neanderthal DNA. This was taken as evidence that modern humans interbred with Neanderthals as they spilled out of Africa, entering into the Middle East, Europe, and Asia between 80,000 and 50,000 years ago. At the same time, paleogeneticists struggled to detect traces of Neanderthal DNA in African populations. This lack of evidence jived with the conventional narrative that modern humans who left Africa and subsequently inbred with the Neanderthals never returned, or at least not in any meaningful way that impacted upon human evolution. The new research now upsets this notion, offering evidence to suggest that there's more Neanderthal DNA in African people than previously assumed. What's more, the evidence suggests multiple interbreeding events occurred between humans and Neanderthals, including episodes that date as far back as 100,000 years ago. Let me drop for a second. Quote, this is additional evidence that modern humans, or ancestors of modern humans, left Africa several times and mixed with Neanderthals, said Pabo. Those modern humans are not ancestors of present-day humans in Eurasia. They were at least partially assimilated into Neanderthal populations, and this happened more than 100,000 years ago. There are two primary reasons why it's been so difficult to find Neanderthal sequences in African individuals. The first reason is rather simple, and even a bit infuriating. The unwarranted assumption that very little Neanderthal ancestry should be found in the African individuals. The second reason has to do with the method used by geneticists, but it's directly related to the first reason. Quote, previous methods to find Neanderthal sequences in DNA of modern humans all use a reference population thought to contain little or no Neanderthal ancestry, and this was always an African population, explained Ackay to reporters. The reason a reference human population was used is that modern humans and Neanderthals share a recent common ancestor, and many places in our genomes will look Neanderthal-like because of this shared evolutionary history. Using a reference population allows you to subtract out this signal of shared ancestry and identify sequences that were inherited because of admixture or interbreeding. Trouble is, this reference population, i.e. the genomes of African individuals, produced biased estimates of Neanderthal DNA among modern human populations. To correct this bias, Ackay and his colleagues devised a new statistical method called IBD-MIX, which did not require a reference population, while still allowing for searches for Neanderthal ancestry in African individuals, which hadn't been done before. IBD stands for Identity by Descent, and it flags identical sections of DNA that are present in two different individuals. These shared segments are taken as evidence of a shared common ancestor. The longer the segment, the stronger the supposed linkage to a common ancestor. This reference-free method applied known characteristics of Neanderthal DNA, such as the prevalence of alleles, mutations, and length of IBD segments, to identify common ancestries tied to ancient interbreeding events. With this method, the team identified Neanderthal DNA in Africans for the very first time, also providing revised estimates of Neanderthal DNA in other populations. Let me drop for a sec. Quote, this new approach allowed the authors to evaluate the possibility of the presence of Neanderthal genetic material in African populations, something that was hidden before due to the assumptions of the methods previously used, which considered African populations not to have any such admixture with Neanderthals, explained paleoanthropologist Katerina Harvati from Eberhard Karl University of Tübingen. The surprising result was that indeed there was a considerable Neanderthal contribution to African genetic material, which was greater than previously suspected, said Harvati, who was not involved in this study. On average, the amount of Neanderthal DNA was found to be around 55 million base pairs per person among Asians, 51 million base pairs per person in Europeans, and 17 million base pairs per person in Africa, though these amounts will vary from individual to individual. In terms of the overall proportion of Neanderthal DNA, Ege said that's a bit tricky to define because we can't analyze all parts of the genome due to technical limitations. But a rough approximation suggests that 1.8% in Asians, 1.7% in Europeans, and 0.5% in Africans. Quote, I think the most interesting finding of our work is that it highlights that modern humans and Neanderthals were interacting for hundreds of thousands of years, and there were many dispersals out of and back into Africa, said Akay. It reveals a more nuanced and complicated history than previously recognized, and shows that the legacy of gene flow between modern humans and Neanderthals exists in all contemporary individuals today. Indeed, this research suggests that modern humans, after interbreeding with Neanderthals, migrated back to Africa, but also points to ancient mating episodes between the ancestors of both modern humans and Neanderthals, perhaps as far back as 200,000 years ago, a claim that's supported by other research. This article joins several studies published recently in pointing out the importance of dispersal, back migration, and interbreeding among human lineages and populations, both in the Pleistocene as well as more recently, and reinforces the view that human evolution was more complex than previously thought, explained Harvati. It also supports previous findings of an ancient interbreeding event before 100,000 years ago between modern humans and Neanderthals. Let me drop for a sec. Harvati said that it was suggested by previous paleogeneticists, evidence shown in several different studies as well as in fossil records. Quote, early modern humans are known to have dispersed in early out-of-Africa migration as early as approximately 200,000 years ago, as recent fossil discoveries in Greece and Israel indicate, and would have had the opportunity to meet and breed with Neanderthals, said Harvati. The authors even hypothesized that there might have been multiple out-of-Africa dispersals and interbreeding events, only some of which can be detected with their current dataset and methodological tools. Interestingly, a sister group to the Neanderthals, the mysterious Denisovans, were likely not part of this equation. Denisovans branched off from Neanderthals around 400,000 years ago and lived in Asia for hundreds of thousands of years. It is becoming more and more clear that Neanderthals were in genetic contact with populations in Africa multiple times during their history, which stands in contrast to the Denisovans, who were more isolated from Africa, said Cervantes. In terms of limitations, Akay said that his team only analyzed genetic data from a small number of African populations, and that a better sampling of African genetic diversity will be necessary to understand patterns of Neanderthal ancestry across Africa. Also, by virtue of how the new technique works, researchers are not able to detect genetic sequences potentially inherited from unknown hominid lineages. Harvati said that many questions still remain, including the genetic contribution of archaic African lineages. Let me drop for a sec. Quote, since we don't have a paleogenetic evidence from African fossils, this is difficult to evaluate and remains a complicating factor, as retention of archaic African genetic material as well as interbreeding between early modern humans and archaic lineages in Africa itself, has also been postulated, said Herbati. No doubt the study is raising important new questions that future researchers will have to tackle. As time passes, and with each new scientific breakthrough, our evolutionary history is somehow becoming clearer, but also considerably murkier. While tempting, these simplistic explanations are almost never correct. Our study is as complicated as it is fascinating. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, very well. On to the next. Manufacturing fantastical things, whether they're toys from Santa's workshop or sweets from Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, is the stuff of dreams until NASA gets involved. The unimaginable adventures awaiting astronauts on long-duration space exploration missions are making it necessary for technologists to use their imagination to anticipate what might happen and design technologies that address the unexpected. The very real constraints of health and safety priorities, budgets, and deadlines mean designing an everlasting gobstopper to satisfy the sweet tooth isn't likely to happen too soon. But experiments are well underway for equally fantastic concoctions, such as the type of lettuce that can treat osteoporosis. Creating medicines on demand isn't something NASA does, so the space agency is turning to experts in the field for help. Humans have relied on plants' medicinal qualities for thousands of years, for everything from alleviating minor ailments to curing serious diseases. Chemistry required for mass-producing biological compounds is complicated, making it extremely challenging to develop portable versions. Quote, sustainability is critical, and it's only recently that the biomanufacturing industry started to even collect metrics on sustainability, said Karen McDonald, a chemical engineering professor at the University of California, Davis. But if you look at how biomanufacturing of pharmaceuticals has evolved here on Earth and look at the larger companies that make biopharmaceuticals, it's very expensive and it's very complex. So this experiment has allowed us to step back and say, how can we simplify things? Simplifying things also means that potentially the cost would go way down if the same technology were implemented someplace like here on Earth. However, one part is portable, plants, and adapting them for space travel and new environments is a viable alternative. McDonald is in the midst of transforming plants into mini medicine factories for future Mars missions. She is genetically altering an ordinary type of lettuce so that it will produce a protein called parathyroid hormone. It's an approved drug for treating osteoporosis. Let me drop for a sec. Quote, one of the projects we're working on is making a human therapeutic that improves bone health because of the lower gravity on Mars and the length of the flight in zero gravity might have a negative impact on human bone, she says. But our real interest is in developing platform technologies for when something arises that we didn't anticipate. There could be changes in the immune system, and you may need to be able to make something to treat related medical conditions. In this example, the platform is a type of lettuce that is transgenic, containing genes from another organism, added by using recombinant DNA techniques. Great Lakes lettuce was selected from several varieties and modified. The seeds for the new protein-producing plants are in the midst of testing to make sure that each plant generates the same kind and amount of parathyroid hormone. If the consistency meets expectations, McDonald and her team will next grow the plants in Mars-like conditions. On the first crewed mission, any plant will likely be grown in a controlled environment that scientists know will work effectively. Hydroponic and LED lighting systems already are tested on the space station and are an option. It's all about how you put together the new technology that you have to develop, says McDonald. We have groups working on the genetic engineering of the plant to increase production efficiency. We have teams working designing the light distribution and plant growth system. In an alternative to LED lighting rigs, the system will capture sunlight from the exterior of the planter habitat and send it through optical fibers into the plant growth chamber. Scientists are exploring the optimal wavelength distribution of that light to get the highest yield from various crops. This effort to maximize the use of natural resources has to take into account the physical location of the Martian greenhouses, and the amount and quality of light available throughout the mission. Other factors, such as resources plants need for successful growth and how much light might be required to generate solar power to operate the environmental systems, must be considered. The resource-constrained environment of other planets and the cost-prohibitive nature of resupply shipments makes it necessary for NASA to develop technologies that will allow astronauts to use what materials are available on the planet. McDonald calls this resource integration and utilization, and says that it's possible the plants could eventually be grown in soil developed from decontaminated regoliths, or the soil is made up of dust and rocks on the planet's surface. Good job, present. Another expensive problem McDonald is trying to solve is purifying the desired compound. Some biological therapeutics could simply be eaten in their plant form, or working in much the same way as eating spinach delivers B vitamins. However, some medicines need to be injected, and those must be in the purest form possible. Current biomanufacturing techniques require expensive hardware and specialized training to remove the compounds from plant material. Quote, you might envision I need to make a protein. I might need to purify it. What process can we have that will allow us to do that, says McDonald. We have designed in a portion of a molecule that helps with purification. We can use the same portion for other target protein groups. On a NASA mission, only a few people might require a drug at any time, so the purification process will only need to produce a small amount of the drug. While McDonald is confident her team is on the right track for creating a streamlined technique that astronauts will be able to follow, she believes the same process could scale up to help dramatically reduce the cost of pharmaceuticals manufactured on this planet. That would be a fantastical factory indeed. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Question.
Okay, on to the next. Newly published results offer compelling evidence that hydrogen is a metal at extremely high pressure. But is the research enough to convince the field at large that metallic hydrogen truly exists? Theorists have long predicted that at very high pressures, over 4 million times the pressure of the atmosphere of Earth's surface, hydrogen should exist as a metal, a material that conducts electricity. Researchers have hunted for this material, at times ending up with dubious results. But in the past few years, teams in the United States, France, and Germany have made strides at confining and compressing hydrogen and probing its properties at high pressure. A new paper finding the strongest evidence yet for metallic hydrogen has been peer-reviewed and published, but the search isn't over quite yet. We've spoken about this before on the Science Talk. To recap, physicist Eugene Paul Wigner predicted 80 years ago that as you crank up the pressure, hydrogen should turn into a solid and eventually into a metal. Creating these incredible pressures to confirm that theory is extremely difficult. The team behind the new research, led by Paul Lebois at France's Atomic Energy Commission, compressed hydrogen between the tips of diamonds using a device called a diamond anvil cell, then observed the sample using infrared radiation at the Sol synchrotron in France. At pressures above 300 gigapascals, at 300 billion pascals, the Earth's atmosphere at sea level has a pressure of only 101,000 pascals, by the way. Anyway, the hydrogen became solid and opaque at visible light at 425 gigapascals at 80 degrees above absolute zero. The hydrogen became opaque to infrared. It reflected infrared wavelengths. And this is evidence that the hydrogen had transitioned from a solid state into a metallic state. Let me drop for a sec. Hubert told reporters this past week that they reversed the process, performing more measurements after loosening the pressure between the diamonds to confirm that the hydrogen hadn't seeped out from between the tips. The key to their result, Lebois said, was twofold. First, they used a relatively new kind of diamond anvil called a toroidal diamond anvil cell with specially formulated diamond tips that can withstand higher pressures than traditional diamond anvil cells. Second, their experiment, and so combined a microscope with a wavelength measuring spectrometer, allowing them to measure multiple properties of the hydrogen in the diamond simultaneously. This past week, the team published the peer-reviewed results of that research in the journal Nature, a sign that they've been held up to scrutiny. The results are close to definitive proof of the creation of metallic hydrogen, according to Nature commentary by Serge Desgrenier, a University of Ottawa physicist who is not involved in the work. But announcing a discovery isn't like flipping a light switch. In many cases, it's more like raising a dimmer. Even now, the paper has gone through peer review. The scientists don't claim that they've observed metallic hydrogen, as demonstrated by the publisher's paper's claim title, which says only that they've seen evidence of the probable transition of metal hydrogen. Limits to the sensitivity of their equipment meant that they couldn't rule out the existence of a small band gap, a small amount of input energy required to turn the material into a conductor. And if such a band gap were truly there, then they haven't demonstrated the creation of metals yet. They write that it's unlikely that the band gap, for the band gap to be there, but announcing a discovery requires covering all of their bases. Let me drop for a sec. One researcher not involved in the study, Zach Gabel, from the Carnegie Institute for Science Geophysical Laboratory, told reporters that the work is a milestone that will lead to further exploration of the metallic properties of this hydrogen and whatever else exists at higher pressures. Gabel also said that it was time for electrical measurements, literally putting electrodes on either side of the material and measuring current through it. These are difficult measurements since they rely on putting tiny electrodes on the tip of a diamond and in contact with a tiny amount of high-pressure solid hydrogen. Another paper from a team led by Mikhail Eremet performed conductivity measurements on their own hydrogen sample and found that at around 350 gigapascals up to 440 gigapascals, hydrogen stayed a molecular solid, meaning its atoms were still bonded together rather than sitting as nuclei in a network of mobile electrons. Though a further transition into a metal may have occurred at pressures of 480 gigapascals. Loubet told reporters that these papers measured pressure slightly differently and are likely compatible, that based on their own calculations, Eremet's team measured at 440 gigapascals might have actually occurred at 390 gigapascals, and the groups may have been observing the same exact effect, but their search continues. Loubet's work is exciting and provides robust evidence that hydrogen begins to take on metal-like properties at high pressures, as was predicted many decades ago. It also demonstrates that a team of a conclusive claim such as we've created metallic hydrogen is incredibly difficult in science and requires a lot of evidence and checking between multiple teams. Quote, I think the community recognizes that the measurements are exceptional quality for this pressure range and we're proud of that, Loubet told reporters. But now we have to go into the pressure range. We'll be able to do more measurements. The research could keep scientists busy for another decade as they continue to elucidate high-pressure hydrogen's very weird properties. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Interesting comment about this. The whole subject of that, the operation of the diamond anvil devices that they use to exert the pressure, that is a fascinating topic in itself. I remember about 15, 20, maybe 25 years ago reading an article, Scientific American, about the design of those diamond anvil presses that they use. It's a fascinating subject in itself. Go ahead.
I agree, John. I mean, think of it in your head. How the heck do you maintain a pressure of something on the order of 4 million times atmospheric pressure here on the surface of the Earth? I'm sort of amazed that they've been able to do it even with something as strong as a diamond. I've read also about that. This is a piece of equipment that they've been using for decades. They've tweaked the design recently, which apparently improves its ability. But it's a fascinating device for a whole field of research that is completely unconnected with daily life here on the surface of Earth. I mean, there are places where pressures get very, very high, probably even higher than where metallic hydrogen forms, but not really on the surface of the Earth. So I agree with you. I find that the tricks that scientists use to tease out further knowledge are usually just as fascinating as the knowledge they tease from it.
I think they've also speculated that metallic hydrogen, that's what...
Yeah, I agree. I've read that too in the literature. Again, you know, once you go out into space, all kinds of interesting things happen, and I can't even begin to imagine what's going on in the core of a black hole. You know, it depends on which type of a physicist you talk to. You know, the general concept apparently is that it is a singularity, which gives me a headache. Whenever, you know, every so often, me and Dick will discuss how electrons don't seem to have dimensions. They seem to be point charges, which is very annoying because you would like it to be this little ball that's spinning. But it seems not to be, and so there are these weird things in our universe. And it always strikes me as wonderful when we figure some way of kind of duplicating somewhat the environment so that we can poke and prod and take a look for ourselves. I don't know if we're ever going to get to the point where we're able to look inside an artificial black hole, but you never know.
GXM?
Yes, Rich.
AC2GS from WB2GXM. The scientists on the Discovery Channel are fond of pointing out that the word singularity to them just tells the rest of the world that they have no idea what is going on.
Good for them, because it's likewise to me. It's unfortunately, when you kind of scrape the surface and you get people to kind of get off their high horse, the laws, the present models that we've built collapse under the weight of these extremes. The problem is that quantum mechanics is great for the minuscule, and relativity is great for the massive. But the massive minuscule, no one has the faintest idea. So, I mean, one of the big things that people are going to be banging their heads up against is a concept called quantum gravity, because gravity is mostly understood through relativity. And relativity doesn't work with quantum mechanics at all. And that's part of the many problems with the singularity at the center of the event horizon of a black hole. We don't have a clue. It's always good to try and figure it out. It's another puzzle on the list of trying to figure out why things are the way they are. This one's going to take a long, long time in my, you know, estimation, but you never know. There might be a very clever guy someplace doing his postdoc who's going to revolutionize the field.
Whatever happens is going to make Mike Rowe very rich.
Mike Rowe.
Voiceover extraordinaire for all those Discovery shows.
Okay, well, it certainly is a way of making a living. I don't know how well. It sort of depends upon, I assume he's kind of the go-to guy, kind of the Mel Brooks, if you will, of scientific documentaries. You know, the more the merrier. I love to listen to them, to watch them. I'm a little tired of expositions on dark energy and dark matter, because I just, in my gut sense, that we got something wrong there. You know, it's sort of very reminiscent. It's reminiscent to me of a century ago when everyone was trying to explain why we couldn't find the ether. That it was there, but it was a sneaky little thing. And some of the greatest minds built some of the best equipment that we're still using Michael interferometers in the gravitational wave detectors. And he built it originally to detect the luminiferous ether that was where that photons or light traveled through, because all waves needed to have a medium. So I don't know, I get the sense that we're sort of at the same place again, that we're banging our head against the wrong wall. But we'll see.
At least we keep banging our heads against the wall, because we have to explain somehow how all the matter in the universe is moving farther away from each other faster. There's something there.
Oh yeah, that's the problem. The problem is that it was a nice, clean universe that was supposed to be slowing down, and they wrote all kinds of things, and it sounds great, because human beings are kind of designed with symmetry in mind. We like symmetrical things, we like symmetrical people, and so when you present the previous idea of the universe in that there's a Big Bang, it expands, eventually gravity overtakes the expansion process, it contracts, you get the big crunch, and that's followed by another Big Bang. And some people said that, well, what happens maybe is the exact same thing that happened the last time. So, you know, not only do we get to live now, but we get to live the next cycle and the next cycle. Others were suggesting that it's just kind of like the randomness of different dimensions and different possibilities. So it was nice and clean. And then, unfortunately, we found out that everything's speeding up instead of slowing down, and you have to figure out why that's happening. One of the things that kind of interests me is the concept that maybe gravity is not a constant. Maybe we don't quite have gravity quite right. And there's lots of tests that are being done of gravity in microenvironments, in single, you know, subatomic particles, and they're looking in the stars for astronomical, large variations in gravity. So I'm thinking that maybe we're going to find out that gravity isn't quite what it's supposed to be, rather than there are these weakly interactive massive particles that are going to be the solution to everything.
The company.
That's just my two cents worth on the subject. There's a lot of guys with multiple degrees and diplomas from prestigious places who are scratching their head and trying to figure things out, and I wish them all well. On to the next. A collaboration between physicists and citizen scientists has led to the discovery of a previously unknown form of northern light. Dubbed the Dunes, the spectacular auroral form is providing new insight into the Earth's upper atmosphere. New research published this past week in AGU Advances describes the auroral dunes, which appear as undulating green-tinged waves in the night sky. The dunes are appearing in the upper atmosphere and likely represent a previously unknown physical process. Physicist Minna Palmroth from the University of Helsinki and her colleagues are the first to document this type of aurora, but the discovery wouldn't have been possible without the help of citizen scientists. This story starts in 2018 when Palmroth was preparing a popular guidebook called, I'm not even going to try this one, it's a very long one and it's in a foreign language. It's finished for a guide for auroral borealis watches. Auroral forms come in various types and each is associated with a specific set of physical processes that happen along the edge of space. Palmroth's book project, which arose from her work from the Northern Lights enthusiast on Facebook, described several auroral forms, but her readers noticed that a certain type of auroral scene in the book hadn't been categorized. They dubbed it dunes. Quote, I looked at the picture and thought maybe we need to make a new category because they didn't seem like anything I had seen before, Palmroth told reporters. Then we started to investigate this together using the citizens' pictures as science data, and since we hadn't done that sort of thing before, we had to develop new methods. New auroral forms aren't discovered every day. An atmospheric effect known as Eve made headlines recently, but this strange light show is technically not an aurora and is instead an optical phenomenon still in need of an explanation. Auroras, on the other hand, occur when solar particles interact with gases in the Earth's ionosphere, the part of the planet's atmosphere that's ionized by solar cosmic radiation. Nitrogen reacts by glowing blue and purple, while oxygen gives off green and red light. In the case of the newly documented dunes, these monochromatic auroras are believed to be glowing waves of oxygen atoms, which are being struck by streams of electrons, according to new research. Fortuitously, the dunes appeared in the night sky on October 7, 2018, just days before Palmroth was ready to publish her book. Amateur observers captured multiple photos of the same dunes at the same time from different locations in Finland. Pictures taken by the citizen scientists and others collected elsewhere at different times subsequently formed the backbone of the new study, as the author wrote in her paper. Let me drop for a sec.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Greatest benefits.
Okay, I think I just made that one. Fortuitously, the dunes appeared in the night sky on October 7th, 2018, just days before Palmroth was set to publish her book. Amateur observers captured the multiple photos of the same dunes at the same time from different locations in Finland. Pictures taken by the citizen scientists and others collected elsewhere at different times subsequently formed the backbone of the new study, as the author wrote in her paper. By using background stars as reference points, Palmroth and her colleagues were able to triangulate the position of the dunes from two locations in Finland that are separated by 172 kilometers, that's 107 miles to us. Results showed that the dunes were appearing at the altitude of about 60 miles. For the event on October 7, 2018, the distance between each auroral ripple or wavelength was measured at around 45 kilometers, or 28 miles. Based on the appearance of six consecutive dunes. Interestingly, the dunes were spotted within the mesosphere, the slightly below the region immediately above it, known as the mesopause. This part of the atmosphere where our planet's atmosphere intersects with space is notoriously difficult to study, leading scientists to refer to it as the ignorosphere. The ignorosphere is too high for radar and balloons, but too low for satellites. Therefore, there are very few measurements of it altogether, mostly from rockets, Palmroth told reporters. Let me drop for a sec. The dunes are likely forming due to a surge in oxygen density in this part of the sky. Researchers attributed this effect, called a mesospheric bore, which can be compared to a tidal bore when a tide travels up a river. More technically, mesospheric bores are a type of gravity wave disturbance that propagates through air, sometimes causing rippling patterns in high-altitude clouds that can be seen with the naked eye, according to the American Geophysical Union. As Palmroth explained to reporters, more auroral lights happen in places where the oxygen is dense, and fewer auroral lights happen where the oxygen is scarce. The bore waves are causing oxygen density to increase and decrease, and that's why we see the dunes, she said. This is significant because the researchers are able to see the bore by virtue of the aurora, which has never been done before. By investigating the dunes, we can get information about the bore waves, said Palmroth, and what's more, the presence of these mesospheric bores in the atmosphere, in the norosphere, may give scientists a new way of investigating this region, she added. Looking ahead, Palmroth would like to gather more observations of the dunes to allow for further investigation. Once again, the efforts of amateur sky watchers would always be welcome. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I know that some aurora also generate RF energy that's put up. Has there been any monitoring type of aurora?
There has been none that has been reported in the articles that I've read about this particular thing, but, I'm sure there's a lot more data available for future papers to be written on the subject, and my guess is that it's probably emitting some form of RF. I just don't quite know what range it might be generating it.
Okay, thanks.
K2MHL. The name's Bob. Could you give us your definition of metal that you were using?
Well, I would assume that they mean that it has a delocalized cloud of electrons that lead to a higher conductivity than other forms of solids.
Critical.
That's sufficient, WA2MHL?
Yeah, name's Bob, I'm here.
Bob, is that a sufficient definition? I'm sure physicists have a much more detailed, wordy and very convoluted way of discussing metallic phase of solids.
No, that's very good. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That's another thing that strikes me as rather fascinating, that, you know, why do conductors conduct more interestingly in a weird way? Why do superconductors superconduct? And the idea of why superconductors conduct is probably a couple of orders of magnitude of gee whiz above the concept that metals have delocalized electrons that just kind of fly through them. They do bounce against things, and that's what causes resistance and what causes heat loss and such. In the case of superconductors, there's Cooper pairs, which are pairs of electrons that are locked together in such an interesting interaction that they can just sail across without interacting with anything else. And they just don't bang up against anything. There's no loss of momentum. There's no heat. That's the whole thing that runs superconductors. So, okay, for what it's worth, there's about 10 trillion interesting things in science. I mean, that's one of the things that attracted me to the subject. Okay, for our last story for tonight, a space story, right, before our space report. The ongoing NASA privatization push just reached an important milestone. The administration has chosen Axiom Space to supply its first commercial destination module for the International Space Station. The habitable module will connect to the station's Node 2 forward port and serve as an example of what companies can do. Axiom Space has plans for space tourism and other private journeys. Officials at NASA hope it will usher in a low Earth orbit economy aboard the ISS, where NASA is just another customer. Axiom won the nod as part of a competition that offered private outfits access to station facilities and a port of their own. It's now negotiating a contract that will include a 5-year base performance period and a 2-year option. It's not certain when Axiom's module will be ready, although it's aiming to offer trips in 2021. It doesn't have much wiggle room as NASA wants to transition to a more privatized ISS after 2024. It's safe to say this will mark a departure from the classic research-oriented days of the ISS, especially when the Russians were selling their own trips. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
WS2N.
Paul.
Yeah, I was surprised they didn't choose Bigelow's company, Robert Bigelow, the one with the inflatable modules. Now they're going to go with the solid-built thin cans. Bigelow has an inflatable module attached to the space station for the last over 2 years now. And I thought they were going to allow him to put one of his larger modules attached to it, but it looks like they're going to go with this Axiom company. So, you know, I know they have a lot of respectable people work for Axiom, so, it's supposed to be good. Bigelow had, he has hardware built, and I don't know if these people have anything. I'll have to look into it. Back to you, Roy.
I think they have more of a fancy idea than anything practical, because I haven't been able to read about anything that you could actually look at. I don't know. A lot of popular press are not looking kindly upon this. They're already making nasty comments that it's going to be a tacky, you know, hotel ISS. And to the point where, as I read these articles, I don't know if you're a fan of the original movie Total Recall. One part of the concept was that they went to Mars, and Mars was not a very nice place. It was basically a mining community, but it had hotels for tourism that were kind of seedy. So I don't know, I had a flashback to that old movie of Total Recall, of the seedy hotel motels on Mars. So I don't know, it'll be interesting to see. I'm not terribly optimistic, I don't know about you. I don't think ISS is really that much of a tourist haven, but I could be wrong.
Well, it's a research facility. I know the Russians have brought up 9 different flights, individuals on board. They'd stay for 10 days, 2 weeks, and then go back. They haven't done that in quite a while. Last one was not, you know, it was recently, but it was, I don't know, it was kind of government funded by the United Arab Emirates. They sent one fella up. That's not like a private tourism.
Complete deal.
So, okay, I know Axiom had, well, they've had plans a while back to do this, so I guess they got the contract for it. I mean, their ultimate goal was to attach a couple of modules, and as the ISS aged, they would deorbit their modules and become an independent space station and still stay up there. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, as all cases, I wish them well. I wouldn't invest in this venture, but, you know, what, I guess, do I know? So it goes. I think people are just trying to monetize everything. I'm waiting for the day that they figure out how to put a little meter on our nose and charge us for the oxygen we breathe.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm just looking this up. They only have 60 employees, 60. I don't know. They better hire a lot of people real fast to build these things. Back to you, Roy.
I kind of wonder what politician's kid is working during the summer in this company. You know, I'm getting flashbacks to bad stories in the past.
Comment.
John, you wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, Roy, KCQSHO. In the movie WALL-E, the spaceship that all of the ex-inhabitants of Earth are on is named the Axiom. Thought that was interesting. EC2GS, KC2SHO.
Very good. Thanks for that one. I had totally forgotten. It was a nice movie. I enjoyed the movie, but I forgot entirely the name of the spaceship. But, yeah, I wish all these guys well. You know, everyone's trying to make a buck out there. I sort of understand it. As long as you don't step on anyone, you know, you take your chances and you see what happens. I'm assuming this is one of the many stories that I've read that just kind of goes nowhere. You know, they never kind of build anything. They never kind of connected to anything, and it just fades away in memory. But we'll see.
What was the name of the movie John mentioned?
He was mentioning WALL-E.
WALL-E. Sure about that one. Okay, back to you, Roy.
It's a Pixar movie where the Earth had basically, people had all given up on the Earth, and they went into a big spaceship, and basically had a fun time in outer space, and everyone was morbidly obese and lazy and useless. And WALL-E was a robot that was just cleaning up garbage on the planet that was left behind.
Okay, I remember that. Okay. Well, said in that movie, the spaceship itself was named Axiom. Is that what John said?
Indeed. That's something I didn't remember at all.
Okay, I'll remember that. That's pretty good.
Paul, can you repeat the fact that did the Russians bring up 9 separate paid tourists to the International Space Station in recent time? I don't think it's been made very public. Well, at least I haven't heard very much about it. Go ahead.
No, they pretty much stopped that, I guess almost 10 years ago. One recently was being, he wasn't really a tourist. He was from United Arab Emirates. They just paid for him to go up. But individuals that had money that did it themselves, I think there were 8. This one guy did it twice. He would repeat. He liked it so much he went up again. But I think it's 9 different separate flights that they've made now. Starting with a fellow named Dennis Tito, T-I-T-O, many years ago. He was the first one to actually pay to go up. He was American. And they've had different foreign people. Anasi, a woman. And they had the Anasi Prize. They're the ones who put out like $10 million for any space company to go to the edge of space 2 times within 10 days. There's been some millionaires that have done that. Let me drop it. I can think of another one that you would know. Garriott, Garriott, the fellow that you talked to on the International Space Station, his son became a billionaire involved with some gaming corporation, and he went up as well. So you can actually say that was a father and son that were astronauts. Back to you, Dick.
Now, when it comes to an ISS tourist structure and people visiting it, I'm very skeptical of this one, because if this is the best of all worlds, the International Space Station would be flying at a much higher altitude where it doesn't have atmospheric drag, and you wouldn't have to be boosting it a couple of times every year. But if you flew it higher, it would be in the Van Allen belt, and the bottom of the Van Allen belt, as I understand, and the astronauts would be cooked. See, between a rock and a hard place as to how high up you are to be safe from atmospheric drag and how low you are to be away from the Van Allen belt. So, except for government subsidy, the ISS is an extremely expensive object. I'm having trouble believing that you could make a commercial business out of that and be economically viable, have enough tourists to go there, paying enough money to support all of the boosting and return and to put a man in space with all of the consumables he needs, oxygen, water, food, and so on, and medicine or whatever, strikes me very expensive. Are you as skeptical as I am, Roy, as to whether or not this commercial ISS tourism thing stands a chance of really becoming a reality? And by the same token, every time NASA talks about in the year 2030, we're going to put a whole lot of human beings on Mars. I'm very skeptical of that. Extremely expensive to do it. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, I'm completely skeptical. I mean, I understand why people have to be dreamers, and if you don't dream, you don't get anywhere. But I think a lot of these things are going to be for naught, and especially the ISS-based one. And during the space report, as soon as I skedaddle out of here, Paul has an interesting story about a congressional bill about changing the plans of NASA and changing the dates and the goals of future projects, which I think are going to end up being, even though they're less optimistic, still a little too optimistic for reality. But you'll hear that soon from Paul. Once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I had fun. I hope you've had fun. If you have any topics you would like me to cover, or really if you have any puzzlers, because those are few and far between, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the stories and the video of the sun and such will be available in about 10-15 minutes when you go to roy.ac2gs.com, my link page. But wait until after the technical net is over and the space report is over before you wander around web browsers. Thanks to everyone, and I will turn it over to Paul for his space report.
Very good, Roy, and I sent you two pictures of the Daniel Inouye telescope. You know, one what looks like closed up on a mountain, and another one more or less how light passes through it. So you might find that interesting. What we'll do is instead of going down, all the way down the line like I was going to do, we were discussing the bill by the House of Representatives that is planning on changing what NASA is up to the last couple of years. We'll cover that first since we've been talking about it. Let me drop it for a second. Yeah, this is WS2N. It's a bill introduced by there's a woman representative, Kendra Horn, out of Oklahoma. She chair of the Space Committee. And what they had is a meeting. You know, this group has bipartisan people, and collectively, Democrats and the Republicans are agreeing to bring this bill forward for a vote, and they planned on doing that the 29th of January, and sure enough, they did vote on it. I was going to bring this up last week, but I wasn't too sure if that was even going to pass, but now that it did, it will eventually go to the full House and see if they can pass that on to the Senate. What it's called H.R. 5666, and what it's really going to do is telling NASA they would like to change their plans on going to the moon the way they plan on going to the moon. Right now they have this mad rush to get there by 2024. 8 years ago they were talking about 2028 would be the earliest. They plan on going back to that date. Let me drop it. That year, 2028. They feel there's no rush to do that. They feel there's no rush to put a permanent base on the moon. They feel there's no rush to start digging up regolith on the moon and going into the craters and digging up ice and living in situ taking parts of the moon and creating oxygen and creating water and using this all eventually to refuel spaceships and to use it for oxygen and using it for a permanent base on the moon. They would like to change all that. They feel it's unnecessary to go ahead with that at this time. What they're thinking about doing is, the plan now that the administration has is this gateway system. They plan on launching a couple of modules, this orbit around the moon, roughly around 40,000 kilometers away from the moon, and then it would come in close to the moon, and again back out to 40,000 kilometers, good distance from the moon. And this would be permanently orbiting the moon, be like a space station. They call it the gateway. NASA wants to pay individual companies to develop their own moon landers. So a couple of them have already submitted plans, Lockheed and Boeing and Blue Origin. You know, they plan on docking these vehicles to this gateway that's orbiting the moon and leaving them there. And they would be able to transport them down to the moon, bring a crew down there, and eventually bring the crew back up and redock with the orbiting gateway space station. And to do this over and over again, these would be reusable vehicles. That's the present plan. To get there, they still would need the Orion spacecraft with the SLS, the Space Launch System, to get the Orion spacecraft and all these vehicles to that gateway. Right now, this committee is thinking, well, this is kind of expensive. You know, if we want to go to the moon, we can go to the moon. If they want that gateway, they could have the gateway. But to have a situation where you're paying individual companies to build their own spacecraft, they don't want that. They want to own the spacecraft. They want NASA to be the owners and operators of these spacecraft that are going to be going down to the moon, responsible for getting people there and bringing them back, which kind of makes sense to me. So their ultimate goal this bill is to someday get to Mars. And they're thinking about putting people in orbit around Mars, not necessarily landing on Mars, by 2033. And that's a big difference from, you know, what they plan on now. They pretty much